Chapter 14. A Case of Do or Die. Its tiered roof, a canopy of scanner, sensor, and communications arrays, Naval Intelligence Headquarters heaved from Coruscant's metallic crust as if thrust up by tectonic forces from the depths of the planet. Along with the palace and the Byzantine Compnor Arcology, which housed the Imperial Security Bureau, the Ubiquitrate, and other ambiguous organizations, Naval Intelligence was the third point of the Federal District's Supreme Triangle. The fact that the shielded, hardened, near-windowless complex more resembled a prison than a fortress had given rise to speculation that its sheer walls were designed as much to keep the agency's staff of tens of thousands of military officers inside as to keep ordinary Coruscanti out. Constructed soon after the end of the war, atop monads that had once made up the Republic's strategic center, Naval Intelligence was a nexus for gathering and analyzing transmissions that poured in from across the Ecumenopolis and from all sectors of the expanding empire. And yet its operations were not conducted in complete secrecy. During the construction phase, micro-holocams had been installed in every nook and cranny so that the actions and conversations of every staffer could be monitored at any hour of the day or night. Not by the members of the Senate's various oversight committees, however, but by the Emperor and the most trusted members of the ruling council. Everyone involved with Naval Intelligence knew that the cams were there and had gradually grown accustomed to their presence. While the officers and others no longer played to the spy eyes as they had early on, they went about their business well aware that at any given moment they might be on stage. Just now, the joint chiefs of the Empire's military were gathered. Admiral Antonio Motti, General Cassio Targ, Rear Admirals Ozzel and Gergerod, and others, along with several top officers from Compnor, including Director Armand Isard, ISB Deputy Director Harris Ison, and Colonel Wolf Yularen. Naval Intelligence was represented by Vice Admirals Rancit and Screed, who had requested the meeting. With the bright light of late afternoon pouring through the tall windows of the palace spire's pinnacle room, Sidious studied their holograms from his chair, using controls in the armrest to choose from among several cams and to provide alternative vantages. The droid 114D stood by him, one of its appendages plugged into an interface socket that routed holofeeds to the summit from what had been a Jedi communications suite in the base of the spire. "Tint the windows," Sidious said, without taking his gaze from the projected holograms.
"Of course, Your Majesty."
With the daylight dimmed, the cyan-hued holograms acquired more detail. The intelligence officers had asked for an audience in the palace, but Sidious had turned them down. Similarly, he had declined to attend their meeting virtually. As nettlesome as it was to have learned that the dissidents in possession of Tarkin's starship had embarked on a killing spree in the Outer Rim, Sidious found the cachet-driven spitefulness of the intelligence chiefs to be even more tedious. So he had dispatched Mos Amida and Ars Dangor in his stead.
"I accept that dissidents have managed to wreak havoc in an isolated star system," Ison was saying. "But the fact remains that they brought only one ship to bear on our facility."
"One ship capable of hiding itself from scanners," Rancit said. "Outmaneuvering our starfighters, outracing a star destroyer."
"Permit me to amend my statement, then,"
Ison continued, as Rancit allowed his words to trail off.
"One fast and powerful ship. Still, they used it to launch an attack on an unimportant outpost."
"The start of a campaign of destruction," Screed interjected.
The officers were grouped around a large circular table, with Mos Amida and Ars Dangor occupying prominent seats. Above the center of the table floated 3D star maps, wireframe displays, and plotting panels, some showing the locations of Outer Rim bases and installations, others the disposition of ships of the fleet, with symbols denoting star destroyers, dreadnoughts, corvettes, and frigates on down to pickets and gunboats.
"We've no proof that the shipjackers are on a campaign," Ison said, taking up the challenge. "Targeting the space station may have been their way of evading capture by Governor Tarkin and Lord Vader."
As a diversion, in other words?
Screed said, in elaborate disbelief, his ocular implant glinting in the light from the holograms.
Governor Tarkin came close to losing his life to his own ship. Given his experience and expertise, we have to assume that the carrion spike is in the hands of a very competent and dangerous group.
I've known Governor Tarkin for over 20 years,
Rancid said in reinforcement,
and I can assure you that if he considers the group to pose a serious threat to the Empire, then they are nothing less.
Ison blew out his breath and shook his head.
Repositioning our resources from Belderon to fortify a couple of minor installations was reckless. We can't run the risk of curtailing pacification campaigns or hunting down former separatists for a strategy of defeat in detail at the edge of civilized space.
And what if the Shipjackers' campaign should expand into the mid-rim?
Rancid said.
The ship gives them the ability to strike almost anywhere in the galaxy.
Ison gaped at him for a long moment.
Is it the Navy's aim, then, to redeploy the entire fleet to effect system denial to a handful of dissidents?
In major star systems, yes,
Rancid said.
Should the situation warrant it?
Rear Admiral Motti spoke to it.
At the risk of sounding too cavalier about this, Governor Tarkin's ship does not have unlimited firepower.
The traditional cut of his brown hair and the boyish features of his clean-shaven face belied an attitude